Welcome, everyone. I'm opening the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and today is February 8th, 2016. And we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 4083. Can I please have Representative McEwen? Senator Roblin just informed us he cannot join us.
Okay.
And would you like Thomas Blastic at the same time?
Blastic would be, I'm sure, more happy to join me.
Great. Thank you. I know this is a very important topic. I would just like to say we will do the formal part later, but if anyone is here for House Bill 4001 or 4143, we are going to roll that over until next Wednesday because we got the amendments about an hour and 15 minutes ago. I want to make sure everyone has a chance to read them. So if you're waiting for that, I want to let you off the hook. It's like, okay, so there goes some of the...
All righty.
We do have other really exciting bills.
Come back.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Peluso. Thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Kati McEwen. I represent House District 9 for the record down on the South Coast. And I'm here today to introduce not only my constituent, Mr. Thomas Blastic, to you, but to introduce a topic that I think is very, very important to all Oregonians, particularly those who deal with elders. I'm going to hearken back to a day, I'll give you the date, May 11th, 2015, which was the first time that this subject was broached. It was a headline in our local newspaper. It says, DHS restricting Baycrest memory care admissions. So that created some interest for me. And we've been watching issues unfold at a memory care facility in my community now for close to a year, just under a year. A number of things have transpired during that time, and I won't belabor you with all of the chronology because it's very, very complex. Licensing conditions were imposed, restriction of admissions were imposed, notices of intent to non-renew were sent to the facility, and Mr. Blastic and his wife, Kathy, have been in contact with my office now since the beginning of this chain of events that have occurred. And I think over these months when this thing has unfolded, which finally culminated last month in an agreement to bring in a third-party management company, it's been difficult. My constituents have been concerned about care that was being provided in a facility that deals with our most vulnerable citizens who have dementia, Alzheimer's, are fragile, vulnerable. And, of course, it's in my interest and in Senator Roblin's interest, who was not able to be here today but would have been if he could have been, to make sure that our folks are well cared for. So I appreciate the good work that Mr. Blastic has done in staying in great detail in connection with my office and Senator Roblin's office over the unfolding of this 10 months. I think I introduced the bill on Mr. Blastic's behalf. It has some very specific requests that have to do with certifications and staffing issues in memory care units. But you'll also notice that in OLIS there is an amendment that I have drafted. I think this is an issue that requires significant review, and I think it needs to be done carefully and thoughtfully, and a short session makes it very difficult to do substantive work on making sure that we're doing the regulatory things that we need to do to make sure that our elders are well cared for. So in the amendment, you'll see the request of the formation of a task force that could go through to 17 to make sure that we're taking a really good look at the structure around memory care. I don't think it's been visited for a number of years. I'm hearing 8 to 10 years. The acuity levels of our elders as the baby boom ages are changing. I think the folks that need this type of care is escalating in number. I think it's time to take a good look at it. I will say that DHS has been very involved in this from the get-go. I've been in contact with the associations that that represent the companies that do this work. I've been trying to keep the conversation very broad and very open to get us to this point. And I'm looking forward for you to hear what Mr. Blastic has to say, who his mother-in-law was in this facility until, I believe, unfortunately, she passed away just a few weeks ago, but have been on the ground involved in this for quite some time. So I appreciate your willingness to hear this bill. I appreciate your willingness to consider an amendment that may make this this long-term look at an event that's very important in my community, certainly, and not only for me, but across the state, as the issues around dealing with Alzheimer's and memory care changing in our state. So, Chair, thank you so much for hearing the bill.
Thank you for bringing it forward.
Mr. Blastic. Mm-hmm. And you want to state your name for the record.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
My name is Thomas Blastic. I live in North Bend, and I'm here to, well, first of all, appreciate the representative's efforts on bringing a bill forward, and also Senator Roblin, his backing, and also whoever else is on that particular backing of this bill. And thank you for the time to say a few words in front of the committee. I'm not going to go through all of your names. So I'd like to start, and I do have a request, and may I approach your bench? I have something I would like to give to you and the committee members. Is that okay?
Mr. Crawford will come.
Oh, okay. Okay. I have some photographs, and there's two sets. The large one goes to the chair because she's the chair. And everybody else gets...
I need to step into my other committee.
Yes, very good.
Okay.
Thank you. And what you'll see is a photograph of... this one here is the very first one that you really need to look at. And this is a photograph of my mother-in-law, Dot Wright. At this time, about 3 months before she died, okay? And a very vibrant woman with dementia, probably Alzheimer's. And the other photograph is this one here. This was probably about 8 months before her death. And the reason I include this, this particular photograph, is because this gives you an idea of what it's like to live in a memory care facility. The very first one, a very vibrant person, an individual with a life history, on a very good day, obviously. And the very second one is something that happens so frequently in memory care facilities. 87% of people that are admitted to a memory care facility are a documented fall risk, 87%. 51% of them actually fall. 51% actually fall, resulting in injuries like this, okay? The reason for the fall can be simply the disease process, because with dementia, especially Alzheimer's, it affects one's balance. But also reasons for fall is over medication. It's lack of enough qualified caregivers to assist with ambulation. 60% of all residents in memory care facilities require assistance for ambulation. 60%. So if you don't have enough people there and they're not trained properly, there's going to be more falls. Also, it gives you an indication of the differences. These are human beings, the differences in the range of emotion that they experience. I would like to, this is on behalf of my mother-in-law, Dot Wright. She was born July 28th, 1925, and she died January 15th of this year. She lived a very long life, and she was an immigrant. She immigrated here from England after the war, 1947, married a GI, combat GI, who was in France, Belgium, and Germany. They had a dairy farm. They raised four kids. She had a very successful life. And developed probably Alzheimer's. She moved out to Oregon a little over 4 years ago. She lived with us for 2 years. And then after 2 years where we were physically unable to care for her, we placed her in a memory care facility. And as some of you may or may not know, memory care facilities, you come into these facilities and you get all this information and you get these very high gloss advertisements and stuff. And the essential, and you've probably seen this on television, some of these ads, they say, and now as a family member, let us take care of your loved one and then you can be there as a daughter, as a son-in-law, as a son, you know, and to really spend time with your parent. That would be great. That has not been our experience. I'm here to represent the residents that she left behind. I mean, she was admitted there October of 2013, discharged January of this year. So she spent 26, 27 months there. Believe it or not, people with dementia establish friendships. She left behind a significant group of friends, you know. And so I'm here on their behalf, too, because they're still living there. So, I've never done this before. I think you can tell. So just real briefly, I think that this legislation is a very significant, important beginning. But it's just a beginning, an important beginning. And I'm glad that the representative added on an additional amendment to really take a look at this in a comprehensive way in the next session. But for a beginning, it's so important to consider this current legislation in its whole, in its entirety. So just briefly, how did we get here today? How did I get here today? Certainly you've got the history of the family with the dementia and all that, and you have the photographs. And what I want you to do is whenever you hear testimony on this bill, I would like each of you to put in your own mind's eye that elderly person that's in your family, you know, who may or may not have dementia. But when you're talking amongst yourselves and listening to this testimony, and I would also encourage the people that come behind me in this testimony to keep in mind who we're really talking about here, and that is these individuals that are in these facilities. And more importantly, at times, we're also talking about your family members also, because every one of us has an elderly family member. So how did we get here? In a nutshell, this memory care facility, Baycrest, run by Radiant Senior Living, failed miserably four surveys starting in March, ending in November. Failed miserably. DHS did what they did. No signs of improvement whatsoever. Not even a comment of, gee, we might have a part in this. I mean, by the facility. There was a huge amount of minimization of this problem. Also, one of the reasons we're here is that one good thing about looking at this, I was able to get information through different state websites, and one of the ones that I came across was neglect and abuse. Right after the very first survey, I looked at the website, and this facility had 14 substantiated cases of neglect and abuse in the last 2 years, as of right after their March survey. Right after their November survey, I looked at the same database, and they now had 28 substantiated cases of neglect and abuse. That's 100% increase. That's unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable. What we know about neglect and abuse is that for every one that's reported, there's five or six that aren't. This is a huge problem. This is not just an outlier. When looking at information from the databases that are provided by the state of Oregon, you can identify facility after facility after facility that has this problem, ranging from Jackson County upwards on to, I don't know how to pronounce the county of Portland. That one. And you can also find out which companies are maybe doing a little better than others. And I would encourage you to look at it from that standpoint also. We know 87% of these facilities are private for profit. Very few are not for profit. We also know that the range of profit that is what the private for-profit corporations shoot for is from 25% to 40% profit. We know that not-for-profit facilities, you look at the little hospital down in Coos Bay, they're happy with a 3 to 5% profit margin. I mean, they're happy, they're ecstatic, and they provide excellent care. Let me just give you just a little bit more information as far as...
So, Thomas, maybe just a few more minutes?
Yes.
So make sure we get to the
fine.
Other
yeah,
people this is, on this bill and other bills.
This is my wind-up.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate
You're doing great.
It. I appreciate it. Thank you. It was mentioned that acuity has increased for these residents. Acuity has increased 25% since 2008. In these facilities, acuity meaning the level of care. We know that things like dressing, simple activities of daily living. 51% of the residents require full assistance, bathing and showering. 59% of the residents require full assistance. Toileting, 55% of the residents require assistance. For incontinence, 60% are totally bladder and bowel incontinent. These are basic ADLs. What we know about the current legislation, the current statutes, is that there's minimal requirements for staff. You can look at the minimal requirements for staff right now. The reason that I'm for this particular legislation to have certified nursing assistants and certified med techs is that we already have a system in place through the Oregon State Board of Nursing that licenses these caregivers. And with that comes a scope of practice and a standard of care and a standardization of education across the board. It's no willy-nilly from this organization to that organization or that facility to this facility. Currently, to become a memory care caregiver, you need to be 18 years old, pass a background check, and I believe have a high school education. And you are given six hours of education by the facility before you can take care of somebody. In order to pass meds, you're given another 6 hours of education, and then you can pass medication. So there is a great need, I believe, for this.
Chair, you know, can I ask a question?
Yeah, can we open it up now for questions? Did you want to do a final statement? And then I think there are people eager to ask questions.
You know, I don't know what I
want to
do.
I want to pass this bill. Okay, would you be willing to accept some questions?
Go ahead.
Representative Taylor, and I know Representative Gallegos wants to.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. Thank you so much for coming today. And I'm sorry to hear that you've been through, sounds like you've been through quite a bit. And I can professionally and personally relate. I, too, have had family members in assisted living facilities and in nursing homes. And I know that it's a lot of trust that you give a lot of trust when you hand over a family member and then want them cared for, so I can completely understand that. I'm trying to understand a little bit better about what happened when the information was brought to DHS's attention and what corrective actions were taken. I'm not in the loop exactly what happened in that regard. Can you explain a little bit about what happened once DHS was contacted and what corrective actions they took?
The licensing came in, failed licensure, and as the representative said, there was a restrictions of admissions placed on the facility. In addition to that, there was a requirement that staffing be increased to two caregivers per neighborhood.
Good.
And also there was a $6,000 fine that was issued because of not meeting the staffing requirements.
Okay.
And also there was a consultant. They were required to hire a consultant of their choice to come in to take a look at their system and to hopefully improve their care.
Okay.
And we do have two more panels coming.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make sure. Is there a new company running the facility, or?
There's a new company called Seasons. One of the concerns that's in my mind's eye is in terms of transparency through this whole process.
Oh, okay.
In terms of not only transparency from the company that was running this, but also in terms of trying to get information from DHS as far as what really has been going on, and how this will impact the facility, and primarily the residents. And so that's been a frustrating response. Getting information.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, I want to first of all apologize for being late. I was testifying in another matter. But I can tell you as a gerontologist, I mean, this is really a matter that's really very important to me and critical to my previous work as well. And I don't know if this is the point to ask my question or another panel might be answering it, but I do hope we can hear. I'm very interested in how much these providers earn. What's the pay scale? What kind of work benefits do they have? What kind of safety benefits do they have, and that kind of thing? I think it's just critical that we really support this workforce, and I'm very anxious to hear about that. Thank you.
Are there other questions from the committee? So we'll hear from the other panels. If we have any further questions from you, we'll ask you. And thank you so much for coming all the way from Coos Bay. Did you want to make one more?
One last comment.
Okay.
I come here not only as a family member. I come here also as a registered nurse who's been practicing nursing since 1977. Mm. I also have a master's degree in health services administration. I know what quality care is.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there. I've been at the bedside. I've been there at the top looking down.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not just a single perspective from a family member. My wife is also a registered nurse, and between us we have over 80 years of experience. So please do not walk away from this that these are family members only. We are family members first and foremost, but we are also professionals in the field. Thank you.
I have one question for you. Is Bayview, I think it's called, the only memory care in Coos Bay?
There is one other memory care, which is associated with one of the long-term care facilities.
Okay.
And they have just one locked wing for Alzheimer's.
Okay. Thank you so much for
Thank
coming
you.
From far away. I'd like to invite the second panel up, Donna Keddy, Ashley Carson-Cottingham, and Anna Potter, please, all from DHS. And while they're settling in, I see a couple people have walked in who may be here for the housing bills, 4001 and 4143, the tenant protection, and one of them had an IZ component in it. We are rolling that over to Wednesday since the amendment just came back an hour and 15 minutes ago. It is on OLIS if you want to see what we'll be voting on Wednesday. So, Nathan, I see you in the audience. I hope you heard that. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ashley Carson-Cottingham. I'm the Director for Aging and People with Disabilities at the Department of Human Services, and I'm joined here by two of my colleagues, and they're going to introduce themselves.
Hi, Chair Kenny Geyer. I'm Donna Keddy. I'm Director of the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight for the Department of Human Services.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer. My name is Anna Potter, and I'm the Community-Based Care Manager for Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, which is basically assisted living and residential care facilities. Most memory cares fall within the unit that I supervise.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to come today and testify on House Bill 4083. And let me begin by saying that we are so very sorry to hear about Ms. Wright and Mr. Blastick's loss of their mother and mother-in-law. The Department of Human Services, through our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, licenses memory care for the state. And we believe that every Oregonian deserves to live in a safe environment, free from abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation, and that we all have the right to live as independently as possible. And we should do so with dignity, choice, and self-determination at all times. Facilities should always be incorporating all of those aforementioned principles. It's incredibly important to us that providers are always meeting residents' needs and that they provide a safe environment and high-quality services for their residents. The department agrees that this was not a good situation that Mr. Blastick just described. There are many ways that we as a department can and must improve all aspects of our licensing and our protective functions for memory care communities and any other settings that we're responsible for licensing and for protective services around. As a state, we are faced with an incredible challenge to serve an ever-increasing population of individuals with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And we need to make sure that we have enough high-quality services for those individuals. We have to all work together and rise to the challenge to make sure that all needs are met for all populations. Among other things that we've been talking about, enhanced training for individuals working within memory care communities is an important way to equip the workforce with the tools that they need to provide those high-quality services. We completely agree with Representative McEwen and the co-sponsors of the bill and with Mr. Blastick and Ms. Wright that there were very, very serious and numerous issues with this particular memory care community. The way that it was managed was not great. And they were out of compliance, as he stated, for a number of months with failed surveys, and it was far too long that they were out of compliance. Again, our expectations are that facilities are always in compliance with the terms of their licensure and that they're meeting all of the obligations to their residents. The good news is that Baycrest now is under management, as you heard Mr. Blastic talk about, and that's full management of the memory care facility by a new company. And this was done so in collaboration and at the urging of the department. We also agree in the future that we need to act more quickly, that the Department of Human Services needs to act more quickly. And it's part of my charge as a new director to this division to ensure that we do. I'm currently doing a deep dive into all of our processes, policies, and procedures to ensure that we're all parts of our organization are doing all we can to protect vulnerable older adults and people with disabilities. I take this responsibility very seriously. The protection of older adults and vulnerable individuals is always first in my mind, and it's the reason that I do this work. As far as Baycrest is concerned right now, we're working very closely with the new management company that's come on board, and we're working with them to ensure that residents are being taken care of and that the overall situation begins to improve. We're paying very close attention through that process. Additionally, the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman has been a wonderful partner agency, and they are also working with the residents of Baycrest. In closing, we look forward to working with Representative McEwen, any other co-sponsors, the members of this committee, Ms. Wright and Mr. Blastic, to address concerns and make immediate improvements in the way that our agency handles the issues that arise and on overall efforts to improve memory care in our state. Thanks for your time, and all three of us are here to answer questions.
Do you have any prepared statements, or you're just here to answer questions? Okay, committee? Questions? Representative Buehler.
Can you outline how many complaints DHS received with regards to Baycrest and over what time frame?
I don't think we would be prepared to tell you the exact number today. I'm sorry, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Rep. Buehler, but we would be willing to bring that information back, and we can detail allegations and investigations that have occurred. Would you like a specific time frame?
Can you do it by Wednesday?
Yes.
Which is when we'll be voting on this bill?
Like the past year of the facility, or?
How long has the facility been open?
Do we have that?
Under the current management?
I'm not sure that we have that information right now, but we can also...
How about a three-year time frame?
Three-year?
Please, go ahead.
And what's current... Maybe I should rephrase this. What has been past DHS policy with regards to investigating such complaints as you've received for Baycrest?
Want me to answer?
Doesn't matter. Can we ask a clarifying question? When you're talking about complaints, what are you specifically talking to? I'm sorry, Chair Kenny-Geyer and Representative Buehler.
Any such complaints? We just heard a 15-minute testimony. What's been past policy and what's current policy?
So, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Rep. Buehler, thank you for the question. We have complaints come into the agency in a variety of ways. If there's an allegation of elder abuse, it's reported through our safe line number, or individuals will call our local APD offices or area agency on aging offices that cover certain parts of the state, and an investigator would go out to begin the investigation within a licensed care setting or in the community. And so that process...
APD is Adult Protective Services.
Sorry.
Adult Protective...
Services.
Services, right.
APS is Adult Protective Services. Those are our frontline investigators to investigate elder abuse for older adults and vulnerable individuals. So they would go out if it was an abuse allegation. there's an intersection between abuse and licensing that Anna could probably get into, but I'll just quickly say that if we get a complaint around a licensing issue and it's strictly a licensing issue and we can determine that up front when the call's coming in, we've just recently created a program. We had a major gap where we didn't have investigators who could go out and have eyes on a facility on just a licensing violation. And so in the last 6 months, we now have what we call compliance specialists who are able to go out with a facility. They're based regionally across the state and look into a licensing violation and start working with the facility, with the resident, writing up reports, and then providing that information over to our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, and then that information is used as you're moving towards your survey process and you have a fuller snapshot of any technical assistance or issues that are happening within that facility.
Point of clarification, but I'm really more concerned about abuse allegations and your performance metrics in terms of investigating abuse allegations. What's been that policy in the past at DHS, and what is it currently?
Would you mind repeating the question?
What's been past performance expectations at DHS to investigate abuse allegations at such memory care facilities, and what are they currently?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Rep. Bueller, I don't know. I don't have the metrics in my head, but the expectation is that every single allegation is, if screened in, that it's investigated. Is that what you mean?
And I would hope so. I'd hope they'd be investigated. My question specifically is, what is the performance criteria in terms of timely investigation of abuse allegations at a memory care facility? In the past and currently under your jurisdiction?
I believe the current statutory time frame, and this might be off, so I'll have to follow up if I misstate, but I believe that the APS investigators have 45 days to do an investigation and complete their reports, and then they are sent over to the Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight. Am I misstating that? It's 45 days?
I'm not 100% sure. I think it might actually be 60, but I could be wrong on that. And then once the Office of Licensing and Regulatory receives the information, we have 60 days as well to provide the final report.
Can I follow up? And how often do you attain those metrics?
I think we'll have to bring that information back to you, but I can get it to you by Wednesday.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you for your questions, Representative Bueller. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Thank you for coming in. I really appreciate the forthrightness and acknowledgement that there's room for improvement. That's very refreshing, and thank you. And I obviously, this is a serious situation, and sounds like the three of you are going to be taking it seriously, which is what we want to hear. However, what I'm trying to understand of what's in the bill here and what's here on our agenda is, we are now discussing whether or not to change this requirement of the level of certification and license for the care providers, et cetera. What I'm trying to understand is, that does that need to happen, what's in the bill, or is that primarily already happening and it just wasn't being enforced? Is there already enough regulations to protect people who are in memory care units or any kind of adult care units, or is it that we were failing to enforce current statute? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm just trying to understand where the, because if there's, if the statutes are already there and there's policies and procedures already there and we were not following them, then let's try to get back to that. Or do we need to be changing the statutes to make it so that the people who are placed in memory care units and other adult facilities are cared for at the right level? So I'm just trying to understand where the breakdown is, please. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Taylor. I think as Representative McEwen said, you know, it's been quite a long time since we've looked at our regulatory structure around facilities, and in particular memory care. And although I think we have the tools present, we have utilized those tools in somewhat of a progressive discipline manner. and progressive discipline, even the word progressive, you know, leaves room for us to maybe be a little more reactive at times. And, you know, when you look at a facility like Baycrest, where we've made, you know, numerous efforts within our statutory authority and within our tools, but yet, in retrospect, it wasn't quick enough and it wasn't enough. I think it does beg the question as to whether we need to look at how we apply the authority we have in maybe a more pointed way. Specific to the bill, I think there's lots of room for us to improve, to look at and how we can be helpful to the providers, as well as, you know, provide a structure that of accountability that that allows us to really use the full breadth of what we have in our rule set.
Just real quick, thank you, Chair Kennedy. I just wanted to clarify if the timing had happened, and it's kind of building on what Representative Buehler was bringing up, if the timing had occurred in the fashion that I think folks would like to see it occur, would we be in a different place now? If the timing of the response had occurred sooner, and the monitoring, and when folks complained and there was investigations, if all those steps had occurred in a more timely fashion, would we perhaps, they would have gotten the message that these things need to happen? Is that fair? Or?
Chair Kennedy-Geyer, Representative Taylor. You know, I think we do have room for improvement. You know, most providers under a corrective action plan will correct, and this one did not. And, you know, we do go back in, and each time we survey them, we find they have fewer deficiencies than they had the time before, and we assume that it will improve and get better, and we try to apply the tools. But I think, again, there's definitely room for us to go quicker on some things and to test that out. You know, as Mr. Blastic said, if we keep our own mother and father in mind and the individual residents in mind, you know, what would we want to see happen? And I think we need to apply some of that to the way we unfold our regulatory oversight.
Why don't I give Representative Evans a chance first, and then Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair. This is more of a statement than a question, and I again I'm just frustrated that again, as you are, that things occur and people that are entrusted with loved ones don't do the things they should do. That said, I want to strongly encourage, in the most clear way possible, that at least as long as I'm here, my perspective will be accountability is not just identifying a problem and throwing more money at it. That the metrics, once we find what the metrics are, that they're either upheld or there's accountability inside the department, as well as outside. And I know that DHS is undergoing a lot of structural review and reform at this point. But I want to emphasize that however we got here really matters, quite frankly, very little to me. What matters is that moving forward, and I use the analogy again, if the ship you're captaining hits a rock, you're fired, and we start from there. The issue of being having people put at harm because of continued lack of actually solving the problem, but maybe making progressive steps, but still not getting to where they need to go. If we need to look at criminal charges, if we need to look at other types of enforcement mechanism, I have zero tolerance for people doing things when they know they're hurting people. If they don't know any better, I understand the education process. But accountability for me, I think, needs to start having a little sharper edge to it.
Thank you for your comments. Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me how many memory care providers there are in the state of Oregon?
Chair Kennedy, Representative Buehler, there are 184 memory care providers. 14 of them fall within the nursing facilities programs, and the remaining 170 are within the assisted living residential care community.
Mm-hmm. Paul, mm-hmm. Can you tell me how many of those 184 memory care providers are under a corrective action plan?
I cannot, but we can certainly, unless Anna knows.
I would not want to misspeak. I'm sorry.
Okay. Paul. Mm-hmm. And how many of those 184 have current license? Aren't they all licensed facilities? Mm-hmm. Are they all current? Yes. That's a yes?
Some of them are pending. I think we would need to have to clarify and provide you with that information. It's somewhat complicated, so I would want to be able to provide it.
But if they have people living there, they are licensed.
Correct.
So pending means they haven't opened up yet and they've got no occupants?
Actually, no. I'm sorry. Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Bueller, if a facility is awaiting to be inspected again, they may have submitted their application process, submitted the application, but the application is pending until we are able to go out and do a survey process, or there might be other reasons why an application is pending. So they are all technically current. They all have a license, but some of it may not be right at this moment. If that, it's somewhat difficult to explain. I'm so sorry.
No, I get it. And how many are pending?
I can't tell you. I don't know that number, but we can certainly find that out for you.
And for how long are they put in the pending category?
I believe I can't give you a month. I'm sorry. It's until we are satisfied the questions have been answered.
Okay.
So the bill, as it was first presented, tried to address some of the concerns here with what level workforce there should be, what kind of training, whether the places should be certified, what kind of accountability within DHS. So it was a quite a large bill. And I think it was very parallel to the kind of work that we're doing in the foster care, particularly the therapeutic foster care system, where all eyes have been on it. And, you know, we care passionately about those who are most vulnerable and often can't speak up for themselves. So you're probably detecting a lot of feelings on this committee of a little bit of a deja vu. And it may not have been in the newspapers as the foster care system has, but it is very disturbing to hear. And I really appreciate this bill being brought forward. There was not the kind of time that Representative Senator Gelser, and I know Representative Stark, has been putting into the child care. This is kind of lagging behind. And I know that even with that bill, it's not all about accountability at the end. It's how do you prevent? How do you make sure there's quality? How can you close down a facility that's not performing when there's nothing else there? So I know these are very, very complicated, but they're very, very serious. And I think I speak for everyone on this committee that we are going to be keeping a really close eye on this. I'm delighted that the bill has come forward, and even if it's being scaled back into a task force to make sure that we know what is the nature of the problem, all the kinds of questions that you're asking, Representative Bueller, and so we can really get a handle on this. And what are the resources? What are the cultural changes? What are the statutory changes? What are the administrative changes that we need to put in place to make sure that we keep our senior citizens safe? Did you want to say anything, Representative Stark, having worked on this? And Representative Peluso is also on the Foster Care Commission, digging into these kind of issues as well.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Things have been going through my mind quite swiftly through this, as having lost my aging parents and those sorts of things, and having been in care facilities where we were very fortunate and had good resources and excellent care. But again, there are tragedies that are associated with that. But you know what strikes me is back again, back in the early 80s when I was a police officer, how we dealt with Alzheimer's and these problems when there was not, when it hadn't really been identified as a problem or a crisis, or it was just an expectation that a family member would take care of the person that, again, we now would say were impacted by Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So I just want to acknowledge that we've come a long, long way with horror stories of transporting people thinking it was a mental illness and doing those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So we just need to keep fighting the good fight, and we need to keep to be doing what is right and best for our folks, and we need to be very open. I really appreciate how open and honest you have been about challenges that, whether are impacting the numbers or just how the work gets done. So we just hang in there. I think we can make the fixes, but again, we need to be vigilant in ensuring that those things happen, and we also need to be a resource to help when needed without interfering.
I want to thank you very much and call up the next panel. Jim Carlson, Ruth Gullias, and Sarah Kaufman, please. And then on deck will be Kathy Wright. And is there anyone else here that would like to testify on this bill? We probably need to pick up the tempo just a little so we have time for the other bills that we have to work today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Carlson, president of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent over 700 licensed long-term care providers throughout the state, running the gamut from small, independently owned government health districts, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs operating the veterans homes, large national companies that are for-profit, and national and local not-for-profit organizations. So there's a broad diversity out there of people delivering services. Our members employ over 40,000 individuals and caregivers who provide care and services to frail and vulnerable older and disabled individuals each and every day. And I wanted to start off first on a personal note and indicate there's never an excuse for bad care, all right? We want to get people equipped. We want caregivers equipped. We want service providers equipped to succeed and deliver good care, high-quality care and services. But in the cases when there are bad outcomes, adverse events, and bad care, we need a very strong and effective regulatory system and framework and strong oversight to deal with those. And I'm very sorry to hear about the situation around Ms. Wright. I probably learned more in as a personal caregiver for my two grandmothers than I ever have in all the policy and academic discussions I've engaged in over the last 2.5 decades in this area. A couple of things. First off, I think it's important to point out that we have an extensive body of rules and regulation governing these types of facilities and licensing. I brought with me just a copy of the rules on memory care communities in the state of Oregon. I'm happy to give you all a copy. They're extensive. Memory care communities have to meet not only the general rules and regulations for assisted living and residential care facilities, but additional rules and regulations to be a certified memory care community. DHS has very broad and far-reaching authority here. They have the authority to issue and revoke licenses. They may restrict admissions, as we've heard. They can limit the number of residents served. They may limit the impairment levels of the residents served based on the capacity of the facility and the provider to meet the needs of those residents. They may require additional staff or staff requirements if they believe there's a situation, and there, as I think was indicated, they're ramping up based on a situation there, they could require that they staff with all RNs under their legal authority. Now, that's probably not something they're going to do, but that's something they have the legal authority to do. They can require additional training for staff. They can require the licensee to bring in outside consultants, be it clinicians or managers. They have the ability to require an outside manager to be brought in, and they have the authority to revoke a license in a case of immediate threat to health and safety of residents. They can revoke that license and immediately bring a trustee in to take over operation of the facility. Now, I can tell you in the last 25 years, I haven't seen that happen a lot, but I have seen it happen, and it was warranted, and it was necessary, and it was needed. In this particular case, I think clearly you had a situation with a provider who was not responding to the corrective action. They were not succeeding, despite being required to bring in outside consultants, despite the fact that we are seeing some increasing regulatory scrutiny and additional requirements. They did not respond adequately. Care and services did not get better. And quite frankly, I think in hindsight, everybody here would probably agree that the state needed to move much more expeditiously in this case. I think it's clear to say I'll never excuse bad care. I'll never excuse a bad caregiver. We were in a lot of very frank conversations with the state in recent months on this, and at least from our standpoint, it was all green light, go. And I think it's unfortunate that as much time passed as it did. A couple of things just very briefly to address points that have been made. There are currently five different levels of state oversight. I think it's important to understand that. You have the licensing and regulatory oversight on both annual licensing surveys, on relicensures. Those are surprise surveys where surveyors come in. Providers do not know when they are going to be surveyed. You have complaint surveys. If there are complaints, as I think Representative Bueller and others were talking about, how many complaints were here, that's a pretty good indicator. And you have complaints that can trigger another surprise survey from the state regulators. You also have the new program that DHS officials outlined, which is the Compliance Specialist Program. That's new. We're very big supporters of it. We think that's a good addition to the oversight. We also have Adult Protective Services. If you have a situation where someone believes there's been a case of abuse and neglect, you have Adult Protective Services workers who will come in immediately and investigate. Now, the timelines on those investigations from start to finish can sometimes take a long time, but if they see something that's creating a serious health and well-being and jeopardy situation for residents, they can move very quickly and in concert with the regulators to come in and take immediate action. And then the last and final level, I would say, of that oversight would be the state long-term care ombudsman program, where there's eyes and ears out there with volunteer ombudsmen as well as people from the state ombudsman's office who can be working in concert with families, residents, providers, and the state regulators on all of that. I'm going to wrap up very quickly with just, I think, two final points. One is to the bill. I don't think the prescription of mandating CNA, CMA staffing in memory care facilities is the right prescription, A, and B, I think it's pretty cost prohibitive. I would love to think that society placed a value on caregivers commensurate with firefighters, police officers, and teachers and the like, and that we had wages that were of that level. The reality is, society has not placed that kind of value on caregiver wages, and you're looking at wages right now in that local service area, Coos County specific, for a direct care worker of about $10.90 an hour is what that starting wage would be. The average CNA starting wage in that community is $13.26 an hour, and the average CMA, certified medication assistant, average starting wage in that community is $16.20 an hour. Only 13 CMAs exist in Coos County right now. There's a shortage of CMAs, there's a shortage of CNAs. And the backbone of your workforce in community-based services in Oregon, and Oregon has a very strong orientation towards home community-based services, is more of a direct care worker or a non-certified resident assistant. The last point I want to make, I've heard some discussion about the need for further study and a task force. Some of you might recall that last May 27th, you had an informational hearing in front of this committee. And I've included in my testimony a copy of the agenda and a copy of the materials that were presented to you on that day. Oregon has a state plan for people with Alzheimer's and related dementias that has been adopted. We've had dozens of experts that have been part of this, elected officials, state officials, experts in the field. They have a very detailed plan and a number of detailed strategies outlined that include training, oversight, regulation, all kinds of different resources. I would like to suggest that rather than reinventing the wheel, we go back and take a look on where we're at. There's a couple of meetings that DHS just sent a bulletin out on January 9th of this year on a couple upcoming meetings about the state plan on Alzheimer's dementia, on active things happening right now trying to implement that plan. And I'd like to leave that with the committee as that might be an area to look at first. In closing, I don't think you've got a legal problem on your hands here, at least in terms of a statutory one. Can we find ways to work together to be more effective, more efficient in our current oversight and our regulations and the application of the law? I would say absolutely, and we'd look forward to partnering with all of you to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I am, for the record, I'm Ruth Gullius. I am CEO of Leading Age Oregon. We're also a statewide association representing not-for-profit and other mission providers of long-term care, high-quality providers of long-term care throughout the state. I was prepared to talk about some of the other initiatives underway around quality and not specifically the Baycrest, and I will agree wholeheartedly with whatever the sentiment of everybody. There's no room for bad actors, and we really believe there are the tools and sanctions in place to deal with them. I was prepared to speak to the original bill. We didn't think that the CNA requirements and the licensed nurse and nurses was the solution to the problem that we were talking about. We are of the we believe that through many of the things that Mr. Carlson talked about, the state plan for Alzheimer's, the multiple new resources that we've added to on training for dementia and Alzheimer's care, as well as the new team put together at DHS to investigate complaints. There's a whole host of existing tools and resources that we think we ought to examine a lot more closely to see how we can focus and really amp those up to deal with quality issues as they arise. And I will keep it real simple, because we've covered a lot of ground. Leading Age Oregon stands ready to participate in conversations in order to do that.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Kaufman, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Alzheimer's Association, the Oregon chapter. From our four offices in Bend, Eugene, Medford, and Portland, we serve all of the counties in Oregon. I wanted to share a little bit about some of the resources that we provide to our state in terms of dementia training for caregivers, family, and professional. In fiscal year 2015, we threw over 230 live education courses, 63 different support groups, and a robust online services and a 24/7 helpline. Our chapter provided information and support in over 80,000 service contracts, and that was helping family caregivers, people living with the disease, and families. And like everyone here today, we're hopeful that through improved access to enhanced training, we might be able to improve the quality of care people with dementia are receiving in our state. And I appreciate Mr. Blastic and his family being here to share his story. And I'm so sorry to hear what they went through. We believe that this really starts by requiring dementia-specific training for all direct care providers in the state of Oregon, any program operating in Oregon. We also believe dementia training should be required for indirect care providers and any that are dealing regularly with residents with dementia. And as Mr. Carlson pointed out, Oregon does have dementia care training standards for care staff and memory facilities. However, providing easily accessible options for independent training will help ensure that people with dementia are receiving the person-centered care that ensures that their behavioral needs, their physical health, and their personal preferences are considered. In 2015, Oregon had an estimated 60,000 people with Alzheimer's disease. And we know in 10 years that number will increase 40% to about 84,000 people. And as it stands, more than 40% of people with dementia are living in some type of supported housing. So this rapidly growing high-need group is only going to continue to need well-trained caregivers who are prepared to meet their needs. And the Alzheimer's Association has many resources to help make sure this happens. In addition to the nearly 300 live education classes that we will offer this fiscal year, we're pleased that we get to collaborate with Oregon Care Partners and offer 50 live classes for caregivers and seven live trainings for first responders. Additionally, the Alzheimer's Association has a nationally recognized program called CARES and Essentials, Essentials with an ALZ at the end. It's an online certification program for individuals working with professional caregivers. And it was developed by the Alzheimer's Association in collaboration with Healthcare Interactive. It's an easily accessible online training module, and these modules use a variety of interactive techniques about person-centered care. It features CNAs working with actual patients living with dementia. And the CARES catalog has about 32 different training modules, and that's 32 hours of training. And the training modules range in anywhere from basic dementia care to advanced dementia care, end-of-life dementia care, and a host of other topics. And one of the great things about this program is there is a certification that people receive upon completion. And it recognizes the evidence-based dementia care practices that are promoted by the Alzheimer's Association and other leaders in the field of dementia care. So the certification that they receive is good for 2 years. They can print it off regularly. It's transferable. And the CARES Essentials program is one of the only 3 trainings in the nation that's supported by CMS. It's also supported by American Healthcare Association and the National Center for Assisted Living, a host of other organizations too. And I will wrap up because I know we're getting close on time. But the message we really want to get across today is that dementia care training matters. And individuals with Alzheimer's disease and other dementia, they have complex healthcare needs that often make the care they receive very challenging and demanding. And lack of training can lead to inappropriate and inadequate care that can compromise their safety and affect some of the most vulnerable Oregonians. But we believe with access to independent training programs like Essentials and courses through Oregon Care Partners, we will ensure that our state will continually strive to provide and increase quality care for people with Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Representative Heap.
Thank you, Chair Kangaer. You mentioned that you had, I assume this was annually last year, 332 live training activities throughout the state of Oregon. How many of those were attended by a DHS representative?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Hayden, I'm sorry, I don't know how to answer that, but we can look through our data to see if we can get some information for you.
But some?
I would think so.
Okay. And do DHS representatives take the 32-hour CARES Essentials training program?
To DHS?
Yeah.
It's not unless it's required by their staff. It's not mandatory. This is an independent program that the Alzheimer's Association offers. So unless it's required by someone, by their boss or someone within the department, no.
From your perspective of dealing with that interaction, would that be helpful for you?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Hayden, absolutely. It's an incredible program, and as I said, it's one of 3 in the nation that is endorsed by CMS and, like I said, a host of other organizations. So the hallmark of the work that we do at the Alzheimer's Association is to increase knowledge and information about how to provide care for people living with Alzheimer's and dementia.
So my question specifically is, would it be helpful for your organizations, your communication with DHS, to have representatives of DHS take that 32-hour training module?
Yes.
Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. Jim, can you tell me why there's such a shortage of trained CNAs in the state? What's contributing to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, Oregon's got about twice the national minimum requirement number of hours for CNA training curriculum compared to what you'll see. So we're 154 hours in Oregon, the national minimum 75. We have a significant number of students who will enter into the class that will complete their classroom hours, their clinical competency hours, but we still have a fail rate on the test of, 20 to 30%. And so it's not an easy program to A, complete, B, pass. And then what we will see oftentimes in the long-term care workforce is they will come to work oftentimes in a nursing facility for about 6 months. And then once they've got that experience, oftentimes you'll see them gravitate into the acute care hospital workforce. And so there's a certain element of the long-term care workforce being the training ground, if you will, for folks who might advance on. We do have others who will advance on in their careers to become a CNA 2, a CMA. To become a CMA, you have to complete an additional, I believe it's 84-hour training. You must practice for 6 months as a CNA. And then we do have some who will progress on career ladders on to become LPNs or RNs. But it's been something. Even when we were in the economic downturn with a higher unemployment rate, we've had ongoing shortages in the healthcare workforce.
Yep. So just a point of clarification, is it your opinion there's enough training programs in the state, but just not enough people who can make it through those programs, or is it a combination?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, I don't think it's any one thing. I will say there is a shortage of trainers, and that runs kind of throughout. I think we'll see in the nursing profession, starting at that CNA level on up to community college RN programs, you have to have master degree nurses heading those programs up, and there's a shortage of the master degree nurses heading those programs up. But we do have a shortage of trainers. We started up a couple years ago in partnership and went through the Board of Nursing process to become the first online program that was approved by the Oregon State Board of Nursing for training for CNAs. And we can do the classroom portion online for students where that's a better way to get their classroom hours, but they still must complete their clinicals and their clinical competencies actually at a facility setting.
So I have a question here, and then I'd like to turn it over to Representative Gallegos. So it's 154 hours here to become a CNA, 32 hours to do the Alzheimer's training or dementia training. How many of the approximately 180 memory care facilities actually require that training?
So I've got
a guess
in your Madam Chair, I can't answer that question precisely on requiring that. A couple things I will say on training. The state funded, out of some money out of the senior medical tax deduction SPA, they funded a caregiver training initiative geared to family caregivers and professional caregivers and awarded a contract to a consortium of groups, which the Alzheimer's Association and our organizations all participate in, called Oregon Care Partners. To date, I believe they have trained over 7,000 caregivers, both professional and family caregivers, with Alzheimer's-specific and dementia training, including what Sarah was discussing, as well as just countless in-person trainings, online trainings. And I will get a report and make sure their most recent quarterly report from the Oregon Care Partners is provided to the committee. It does also, Representative Hayden, break down the number of folks from the agency in the report who have attended some of those trainings as well.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
I really want to thank all the panelists for it's such a critical issue to be discussed here and to draw attention to it. It seems to me that we're also talking, as I mentioned, my concern about the workers and care providers. This is a discussion that should be being held in higher education and workforce development as well. And we really need to look at that whole process about how we are developing this workforce and paying a legitimate wage and so on. So thank you for bringing it to us.
Thank you. And the last person on this is Kathy Wright. We're going to have to work our bills quickly.
I think that's an incentive.
Thank you for giving me a few moments. I wasn't sure I could speak today, given the recent death of my mother. But, you know, throughout this country, in all the hospitals, there's a program.
Just for the record, for people listening in archives, could you just state your name for the record?
I'm sorry, Kathy Wright.
Thank you.
From North Bend. Throughout this country, in every hospital, there's a program called Speak Up. When you go into the hospital, you're given the pamphlet, and you are encouraged to ask about what medications you're giving, what procedures are being done. You and your family members are encouraged to advocate for your care. Who does that in Alzheimer's units? Can somebody who has impaired judgment, who has memory issues, who has decision-making problems because of a progressive, untreatable, terminal brain disease, who speaks up for them? You can have rules, you can have regulations, you can have policies. What you need to do is go sit in these facilities for 4 to 5 hours a day, which Thomas and I did for 27 months, and you will witness the actual staff shortages. You will witness people who cannot speak up for themselves and do not have family advocates that are sitting in the same chair for 6 hours at a time, have not been taken to the toilet, have not been ambulated. They sit there in front of food that's been in front of them for 4 to 5 hours, when more than 2 hours is considered unhealthy. You do not leave food out for more than 2 hours. Okay. You see people that are asking for help, and staff are walking by without looking at them and saying, I'll be with you in a moment, sweetie. I'll be there, baby. I'll be there later, sweetheart. Okay? Not even acknowledging their names. Since the mid-1980s, a part of respect and dignity for people in Alzheimer's units is to call them by names. Okay? By the time they get there, they have two things left that is personally theirs. That is their name and their feelings. Everything else is gone. The spouse is gone, the job is gone, the car is gone, the work is gone, the memory is gone. What they have is their feelings and their names, and both of those things are often ignored in these facilities. Okay? Our name is the first thing we're given when we're born, and it's the last thing that's etched in stone when we die. Okay, that is ignored in these facilities. They use terms of endearment that is totally dismissive and without respect and dignity. The issues at Baycrest are not isolated to Baycrest. Okay, Radiant Senior Industry owns 14 for-profit facilities in 3 different states in the Northwest. These issues are all across the country. The reason that Baycrest has been identified is there's been 2 registered nurses in one of their facilities 5 hours a day for the last 27 months. Okay. The caregivers that are there, many of them are very, very kind people. They haven't a clue as to what they're doing. The brochures say that they are highly trained staff in a highly specialized unit. They are not. They will tell you that. Some of them would like to go on and be CNAs. So if it was mandated that they had to be CNAs, then they wouldn't be transitioning into other facilities. Okay, do they deserve $2 more an hour? You bet. The people that they're taking care of are the World War II, post-World War II people. They are responsible for the chair that you sit in today. Okay, these were the hard-working people. Not only do they have Alzheimer's, they have high blood pressure, they have heart disease, they have diabetes, they have other health issues that these caregivers cannot recognize. Do they get less care because they're elderly, because they have brain damage, because they're DNR? DNR stands for do not resuscitate. In other words, allow natural death. It does not stand for do nothing, right? They are not getting their basic needs met because they get 6 hours of training. I had handouts that I would give to caregivers on how to communicate. I said, I'm sure you got this in your training. They said, we didn't get any handouts. We didn't get any handouts. You can sit in front of a computer module and listen to a lecture and answer the questions. It's not the same as sitting in a classroom and having a discussion and having an interaction and asking spontaneous questions where you get more information. Okay, so some of the criteria might be met, but the care is not being provided. Okay. So who speaks up? Okay, in hospitals, we all speak up. Talk to family members there. They're so fearful of retaliation. And the first time that I spoke up to one of the owners of Radiant Senior Living, she suggested that I find another place for my mother. Okay, that's a non-veiled threat. Okay. Being my mother's power of attorney and as a registered nurse and knowing her rights and my rights, I knew that she could not retaliate beyond that veiled threat. Other family members have, and even people going into hospitals are afraid to speak up because they're afraid of retaliation. Mm-hmm. Who speaks up? Okay. 6 hours of training versus 6 weeks as a CNA, mm-hmm. Why do they not deserve that kind of care? That MedAirs, they did not know the difference between 30 milligrams and 30 cc's. One is a measurement of volume, the other is a measurement of dose. And I would ask them, I would see a different medication in my mother's cup and say, what is that? I don't know. So what medications are you giving her? I don't know. I work on another unit. I don't know what your mother gets, but they were still going to administer it to her. And it was only because Thomas and I were nurses that we identified these issues and saw that my mother was not giving proper pericare, which resulted in urinary tract infections, which resulted in a delirium. Every UTI and delirium advances people's Alzheimer's to another level that they don't come back from. They then get put on antibiotics that they can then become resistant to because they were not cleaned properly. They're not given enough water for hydration. Okay. They're not responded to in their social needs. This is not isolated to Baycrest, so please do not just identify the problem as being with one facility. Okay. If every facility had two family members that were registered nurses mm-hmm. and were there 4 and 5 hours a day, okay, DHS would not be able to handle the number of complaints coming in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Kathy.
So I just wanted to talk about, you know, the speak up that you get in the hospitals.
Yep.
We need to speak up for people that are in long-term care. DNR does not stand for do nothing right.
Yeah. Thank you, and I'm sorry for your loss. Thank you very much for bringing this issue to us. Okay. No more questions, comments. I'm going to close the public hearing on 4083 and open a work session. For the purpose of rolling over, I have to open them up, right? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4001 and 4143 just for the purpose of rolling them over to Wednesday. The amendments for 4143 came in about an hour and 15 minutes before and didn't give people a chance to really read them. So we'll do that on Wednesday. And 4001, we will decide on Wednesday whether we're passing it on to rules or what we're doing. So I'll give you a heads up as soon as I know. I'm going to close the work session on those two, open a work session on 4042. And
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 4042 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for prior reference.
Representative Peluso moves House Bill 4042 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Just for your memory, this is the general assistance bill, and there is a fiscal of exactly what John Mullen predicted it would be, just below $1.7 million. Is there any discussion, or would anyone like to ask John Mullen any more questions before we take the vote? A statement. We're happy
Thank
to have
you,
a
Chair.
Statement by my vice chair.
Good job, John.
Good job. John has worked really hard for many years to reinstate this program. This is a very modest start with a very important population. Any other discussion or comments? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
I am going.
Yes.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Hi.
Aye.
Representative
Parrish. Excused.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Peluso.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Smart. Yes. Chair Kenny Ryder. Aye. Okay. House Bill 4042 passes on to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And now opening a work session on House Bill 4144.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated February 3rd, 2016.
Representative Peluso moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated February 3rd, 2016. Let me just explain. This is the amendments that on the earned income tax credit and low income tax credits. Basically taking a more prescriptive original version and replacing that with a task force headed up by DHS. A number of people are identified in the task force for the purpose of increasing the utilization rates for the low-income tax credits. So that is the purpose of the -1. Is there any further discussion on that? Any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted. Representative Peluso.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 4144 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Peluso moves House Bill 4144 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Well, I would just like to say something here before we vote. Thank you very much to DHS for being willing to take this on. As we heard from the prior testimony here, DHS has a lot on its plate, and yet you've heard very loud and clear that it's really important that we reach out to all corners of the state and increase the utilization for low-income people to be able to keep the dollars and get the federal dollars back in their pockets when they've earned it. And I know you have we pleaded with you to not put a huge fiscal. The fiscal came back as minimal, even though you will be staffing this, and even though there are some small reimbursements. So I want to acknowledge that you are stepping up. This could be seen as a little bit of an unfunded mandate. I trust it'll be small workforce, but it has the important people to get together, and I anticipate that once you get together, you may have some plans about the kind of outreach that we should be supporting. There may be a fiscal attached to some of those outreach efforts or marketing plans in the future, but I really appreciate you stepping up to take on this work that really needs to be done and taking the lead on that and not putting a big fiscal on it. It's very noted and very appreciated. So with that, is there any further discussion?
Just real quick, I love the bill. I like the concept of unlocking federal dollars, and I'm hoping to get support for another joint resolution that does a very similar thing.
Thank you for that comment. And I know that they've heard that several times. They're going to be looking at ways to intersect with the Veterans Administration. Okay, no further discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Yes.
Yes.
Aye.
Hayden.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Peluso?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Chair Kinnegar? Aye. Okay. Passes and on to the Committee on Revenue and close the work session on House Bill 4144. Any more comments before we get out of here early?
Oh, no.
All right. Great. One more day. Please, everyone, come on time next time. We'll have a more full agenda next time to get through. That'll be our deadline for passing bills out of the committee. All right. Hearing is closed.
Oh, my gosh. Margaret, good to see you. I'm coming down. Just a minute. Oh, my gosh. Margaret, good to see you. I'm